Hello and welcome to Foxed, the practical podcast series from Fox & Partners. In these podcasts, we'll be looking at scenarios from our day-to-day practice, offering solutions to some of the most pressing partnership and employment law questions we hear from our clients. Our goal is to offer a digest of some of today's key issues in a succinct and practical style that we hope you'll find useful and engaging. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Jackie Thomas. I'm a legal director at Fox & Partners, and I'm here with my colleague, Senior Associate Shiv Raja. Today, we're talking about the FCA consultation on diversity and inclusion and what this will mean for financial services, employers and employees. It's also worth noting that the proposals in the consultation paper would also apply to LLP members who fall within the current regulatory framework. In the first of two podcasts, we focus on what the proposed changes relating to non-financial misconduct are, and then use some practical examples to explain what the impact of them will be on businesses and on individuals.
Thank you, Jackie. By way of background, in September last year, the FCA and the PRA launched consultation papers, which aim to consult on an upgrade to the current regulatory framework around diversity and inclusion in the financial services sector. The consultations were also followed by a helpful webinar by the FCA and PRA at the end of October. Today, we will be looking at the detail of the FCA's consultation and some of the interesting points that raises, particularly around workplace culture.
Very interesting. Shiv, do you want to quickly outline for our listeners what the main proposals are?
Yes, the proposals are quite wide-ranging, Jackie, and very much depend on the size of the firm. The proposals will impact all firms, but firms with 251 or more staff will be the most impacted. In summary, the regulators propose three things. Firstly, bringing non-financial misconduct more clearly within the scope of the SMCR regime. Secondly, requiring large firms to report on diversity and inclusion data. And thirdly, requiring large firms to put in place a strategy and targets for diversity. The entire consultation is worth reading, but today we will be focusing on non-financial misconduct.
Great. Before we turn to non-financial misconduct, though, a key takeaway for me from both the consultation documents and the webinar is that the regulators are positioning this as very much integral to their regulatory role. It's very clear that it's not seen to them as an add-on, so it's fair to expect that any failure to embrace these measures will be taken very seriously. Shiv, should we start by looking at what the consultation proposes on non-financial misconduct?
Yes, one of the key areas covered by the consultation is a clarification by the regulators that the concept of misconduct, which we are already familiar with, does include non-financial misconduct. Whilst the FCA said in 2018 that non-financial misconduct is misconduct, plain and simple, things have not been plain and simple for firms when they've had to decide whether non-financial misconduct affects fitness and propriety and whether it is a breach of the conduct rules. As things currently stand, the FCA handbook provides very little help on what non-financial misconduct is, when it would apply, and whether it would amount to a breach of the conduct rules or go to a firm's assessment of fitness and propriety. No examples of non-financial misconduct are included in the conduct rules, and firms and regulated individuals are very much in the dark.
And this is a clarification?
It is. The consultation document refers to the FCA making it explicit that non-financial misconduct will form part of the conduct rules, fitness and propriety assessments, and suitability guidance on the threshold conditions. In my experience, most practitioners have always thought that non-financial misconduct should be treated as misconduct for regulatory purposes, depending on what the particular act was, and the consultation notes that the vast majority of firms already understand this. However, the changes proposed by the FCA will make this clear.
And how do they do that?
Firstly, the consultation proposes an amendment to the fit and proper test, and secondly, it proposes an amendment to the conduct rules. The proposed new rules are set out in the appendix to the consultation, and it is definitely worth reading as it gives some detail to the proposals and what they mean in practice.
Yes. In particular, there is a key difference between the scope of the conduct rules as opposed to an assessment of fitness and propriety, isn't there?
Yes. It is currently the case that for firms which are not SMCR banking firms, the application of the conduct rules is restricted, and the FCA's conduct rules apply only to conduct that is limited to the firm's regulated activities or an activity carried on or in connection with a regulated activity and certain kinds of misconduct that could have serious effects. The effect of this is that conduct which is wholly unrelated to those regulated activities is unlikely to amount to a breach of the conduct rules. For SMCR banking firms, the conduct rules apply to regulated and non-regulated activities. However, there is still some uncertainty around this issue, and it appears that there must be a sufficiently close connection between the non-financial misconduct, what the individual does, and what the firm does for the conduct rules to be engaged. The FCA proposes to expand the scope of the conduct rules so it covers things like bullying and harassment towards fellow employees, and it proposes to add guidance into the conduct rules in relation to when the conduct would fall within scope and also when it would be out of scope because it relates to someone's private or personal life. The distinction between someone's private life and their work is currently a tricky issue with the conduct rules, so the changes proposed in the consultation would be really helpful.
Which is where the fit and proper test comes in. The test doesn't have the same restrictions as there are in the conduct rules. We already know that the test looks at a person's wider suitability for a role, so we've historically seen examples of someone's behaviour in relation to financial matters outside of work being taken into account. However, the bar to find that an individual is not fit and proper is high. What the updated rules make clear is that non-financial misconduct should also be taken into account when assessing fitness and propriety, and in particular, assessing honesty, integrity, and reputation. The amended rules make clear that this covers convictions related to violence, sexual offences, or other protected characteristics, circumstances where a person has been asked to resign following involvement in discriminatory practices, and where they have been found by a court or tribunal to have been involved in discriminatory practices.
Yes, and it goes even further. It expressly covers a situation where a person is subject to an upheld internal complaint relating to discriminatory practices or where there has been misconduct outside of the regulatory system, including in their private life, for example, violence or sexual misconduct, even where this does not result in a criminal conviction. So, all in all, this is potentially a big issue for firms and individuals.
Thanks, Shiv. So that's the theory covered. To make this more practical, we thought it would be helpful to consider how this might apply in practice using some theoretical examples. Let's start with an inside the workplace example. We've recently seen a lot of focus, for example, with the Dominic Raab investigation, into the boundaries between a robust management style and bullying. Here, let's consider a senior manager. We'll call her Kate. Kate is a certified employee in an investment bank, and she has been accused of bullying by a graduate trainee, Ed. Kate is adamant that she hasn't bullied him and that Ed has reacted badly to genuine feedback on his performance. However, when discussed with her, Kate admits that this isn't the first time issues have been raised about her style of management and that HR have said her name has been mentioned unfavourably by other junior staff in 360-degree appraisals and in exit interviews. So what impact would the new rules have?
Well, the first thing we'd note here is that there is proposed new guidance in the conduct rules relating to misconduct in relation to fellow members of the workforce, which means that the treatment of a colleague at work is a matter which is potentially a breach of conduct rule 1, which is acting with integrity. So this is potentially serious for Kate.
Are we saying that she's definitely breached the rule?
Not necessarily. It's a bit more nuanced. The new section of the guidance on Rule 1 makes it clear that a good working environment is one where employees feel respected, valued, and able to give their best and are treated with dignity and respect. However, the guidance does say that only misconduct in relation to a fellow member which is serious will be a breach, which means that not every instance of misconduct towards a fellow member of the workforce will amount to a breach.
That's quite subjective, isn't it? What does serious mean then?
As an employer, I would look at the guidance because it sets out a number of factors the FCA would take into account when deciding whether misconduct in relation to a fellow worker is serious enough to amount to a breach of the conduct rules. Some of the things the FCA would look at include whether the conduct is repeated or part of a pattern, what the seniority is of the person whose conduct is in question, whether there is a disparity in seniority between them and the person impacted, whether the conduct is related to a protected characteristic, and whether the person has previously undertaken not to do the act in question. Some of these are applicable to Kate's situation.
That may not be good for Kate. There is also proposed new guidance on Rule 1, which gives individuals a possible defence, where they thought there was a good and proper reason for the conduct, or where they did not intend to have a negative effect on their colleague, did not know that they were doing so, and were not reckless as to the effect of their conduct. It isn't yet clear to what extent firms will be willing to take a lenient approach to employees on the basis of this. But even where this is the case, it's also worth noting that even if Kate can rely on the defence on the basis of her intentions, the guidance goes on to say that the conduct may then instead be a breach of Rule 2, acting with due care and skill as a manager.
Yes, I think Kate is potentially in a difficult situation here.
Yes, agreed. And of course, it's potentially compounded by the fact that there may also be a fitness and propriety issue. As we saw, this kind of behaviour could go to honesty, integrity or reputation. And even if not, if it's a question of poor management, it may go to capability. And while it may be the case that this would have been treated seriously under the current regime, it's also regrettably common for firms to prioritise star performers with some question marks over their conduct above concerns of junior staff. Taking that approach is likely to be much riskier for firms going forward for the reasons we'll come on to.
Thank you, Jackie. Let's look at a slightly different scenario. Bill is a senior manager. He recently attended a charity Christmas gala arranged by another member of the management team, Jenny. Shortly after the party, Jenny approached the bank's general counsel, Maxine, to say that she has serious concerns about the way Bill behaved at the party. In particular, Jenny said that Bill was drunk and made inappropriate and sexually explicit comments to her at the bar at the end of the evening. Jenny knows that the bank has a diversity policy in place, and although this behaviour wasn't in the office, she thinks action should be taken. What should Maxine be doing here? Is this a work issue at all, or something private that can be ignored?
Well, as a starting point, Maxine is right to note that this happened at an event outside of work. This means it may not be a conduct rule breach. The draft guidelines have a table which give various examples of whether something falls within the rules or whether they are private, personal matters. This gives an example of misconduct by A in relation to a fellow member of the workforce at a social occasion arranged by them in a personal capacity. That would be outside of the scope of the rules. However, where an event is arranged by a client and the main reason for the invite is that they work for the firm, this does fall within scope. Our scenario here potentially falls somewhere in the middle and therefore may need careful consideration. However, if Bill and Jenny were both there in a personal capacity, it's likely that this won't be a conduct rule breach.
Well, this, of course, doesn't mean it's not a problem for the firm or that they can ignore it from an employment law perspective. It does, however, raise a potential fitness and propriety issue. This could be the case if Jenny makes a formal complaint and it is upheld. It could also be the case if the firm assesses that it is an example of misconduct in Bill's personal life, which suggests he lacks moral soundness, or that it is behaviour which he may repeat in his role. Here, it becomes quite nuanced. Exactly what Bill did and said is likely to be relevant. Does this mean firms have to investigate these matters even where they are outside work?
Potentially, yes, as there are further risks in not doing so.
Can you expand on that?
Yes. So the sting in the tail is that there may be a further regulatory risk arising from this, which may rest with Maxine. The amended rules go on to confirm that a failure to take reasonable steps to protect staff or to take seriously and deal effectively with complaints is a breach of conduct rule 2, the duty to act with due skill, care and diligence. And what this means is that Maxine is now on notice of a potentially problematic behaviour by Bill. And she has two choices. She could decide not to take further action on the basis that it was outside of work and she doesn't think it's sufficiently serious to be a fitness and propriety breach. But should a further issue arise at work and this come to light, she may be at risk under Rule 2. It's not yet clear to what extent the regulators will pursue this route, especially in the respect of roles like general counsel, head of HR, or compliance functions where there is a likelihood that they will be receiving complaints. But it's something to watch as it could result in firms taking a more cautious approach to complaints. The potential consequences of this for someone in Bill's position could be significant, and it may lead to a lower tolerance of matters that could amount to non-financial misconduct, but may be borderline, either because they may not be serious enough or because they occur outside of work.
It's worth pausing on why this matters. There are four key issues in our view that makes this important for firms and staff. Firstly, our view is there will be a greater risk of individuals and firms falling foul of the rules arising out of non-financial misconduct, an increased risk of sanctions by the FCA. We think there is going to be an increasing awareness of this issue, and the other part of the FCA's proposal, which requires the collection and publication of diversity and inclusion data, will mean that there is a new pool of useful data to support this.
Second, another point to note is that individuals who are accused of non-financial misconduct may feel that they have to fight to clear their names when they believe a decision has been taken that is not fair. This can increasingly be the case where there is a regulatory reference on the line. Firms cannot agree to give a clean reference where they believe there are fitness and propriety issues, but this could lead to issues being career-ending, even when the individual chooses to leave rather than go through a formal process. This could lead to more claims and higher settlements, but equally settling claims in these circumstances is also problematic, given the wider remuneration code issues associated with rewarding failure.
Thirdly, the proposed changes places greater risk on firms. As well as impacting on conduct rules and fit and proper assessments, the new rules make it clear that issues such as whether the firm or a person connected with the firm has been found by a tribunal or court to have been engaged in discriminatory practices will be taken into account when assessing whether a firm satisfies threshold conditions. Practically, this may put pressure on firms not to fight claims where there is a risk that findings may be made on discriminatory practices, and we may see firms more willing to settle with claimants early.
Finally, linked to point three, firms need to consider potential reputational damage. We have already seen this following Me Too, but it's worth noting that cases of non-financial misconduct can be salacious and newsworthy. This in turn can cause both personal and professional embarrassment for individuals and reputational damage for firms.
The changes are unlikely to take effect before the middle of 2025 and could, in theory, still be watered down. But as we've said, the FCA sees this as a clarification, so to a degree, firms should be wary of discounting allegations of non-financial misconduct now, especially where there are potentially issues of serious concern. So, to close, we thought it would be helpful to consider some of the actions firms can take, both to minimise the risk of failing to adequately deal with misconduct under the existing rules, and to ensure that they are well placed for the forthcoming changes. Jackie, what can firms be doing now to prepare?
Well, as a start, stay on top of developments. The regulators anticipate publishing the final position this year, with a year to prepare before the regulations change. It is important to take this time to prepare. Three things to consider for this are: firstly, look at your approach to misconduct now. This has a variety of facets, including how annual certification is managed, but also how matters are investigated when complaints are raised, and how the overlap between HR, employment, compliance, risk, and regulatory functions are managed. Second, be clear on the reporting requirements for these matters. These rules can be missed when something starts as an HR issue. It's important where a disciplinary issue arises to make sure that compliance are involved at an early stage and what can seem to be HR issues are looked at with a regulatory lens. And then thirdly, honestly assess any cultural issues you have now. Are there teams where banter or inappropriate behaviour may have persisted? Can you run training or take other steps to improve matters before the rules come into force? This does take time to show results, so starting in 2025 is likely to be too late. So that leaves firms with plenty to think about. And if that wasn't enough, this is only part one. In our second podcast, we will cover another issue likely to come under increased focus: positive action. In the meantime, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Foxed, and we hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe via your usual podcast platform, or you can find more details at our website, foxlawyers.com.